Hello, I'm Shireen Gourbani, and you're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle.
And this is our unsupervised edition. I'm John Dougal.
John, tell me just a little bit. I know we've done this many times, but just a little bit about your political background.
So, political background, I served in the House of Representatives for a decade, representing Northeast Utah County, Alpine Highland, American Fork, a little bit of Lehigh, a little bit of Draper. Very conservative. I'm first and foremost a fiscal conservative.
Yeah.
Very limited government kind of guy. And then ran for auditor and served as state auditor for 12 years.
Yes.
As Utah's watchdog.
Yeah, that's right. So, frugal. Frugal Dougal.
And I tell folks, my dad was Frugal Dougal before he's even born. So it's, I'm the oldest of 11 kids. Frugal is all I ever knew growing up.
I'm sure. So
sometimes my wife just calls me cheap.
And I am, well, I'm Shireen Gourbani. I had the honor of representing Salt Lake County on the county council at large. So representing this entire county, which makes up about a quarter of the state's population. Before that, I ran for the United States House of Representatives, really driven out of a basic desire to see universal health care in this country. I consider myself a progressive, certainly on the left. But this may be an episode where we come across some very common ground, because I think some of the concerns that are happening at the national level is a place where we overlap. And I'll say it's also kind of a similar situation. I would say, I don't want to paint you as a Mike Lee guy, especially these days. But, you know, sometimes I find that Mike Lee and Bernie Sanders align occasionally. I think Mike Lee's maybe gotten off of some of those sequences. But we might have some unusual common ground in this episode.
Well, so, and you and I both ran for Congress.
We did.
Different reasons. I ran because I was concerned with the out of control spending and the bloat of the federal government. But
yeah,
I mean, I think you and I both agree Congress is broken.
Yes, we do, certainly do. So let's start with some, it's going to be difficult for us. We are recording this on Tuesday morning. By the time you hear this, there could be very different circumstances. So we'll just say that there continues to be, I would say, unraveling diplomatic relations.
There's a ceasefire or not a ceasefire.
Or if we're in full-blown war.
Yeah.
I mean, in the Middle East, in particular, a strike that came from Israel into Iran was then countered, and then the United States got pulled into this. All of this to say,
stepped in, however you want to describe it.
We're not sure where it is now when you're listening, but we want to talk about some of the broader issues here. And one of them, I think, is really central. And again, I think a place where we may have common ground around war powers. So talk us through this, John.
Yeah. So a lot of people are talking about whether or not it was constitutional for the president to bomb Iran. So and this is one of those things. So let's talk through some of the history. So you look at the Constitution, Article 1, Section 8, talking about Congress, says Congress has the power to declare war. Not the president, Congress. It also talks about Congress raising and supporting armies, providing and maintaining for a navy, and so forth. Then when we get into Article 2, this is where it talks about the president being the commander-in-chief of the army, navy, and the militia. So given that, We step back and we say, okay, what does this mean when it comes to declaring war? And one of the key things that I'm just going to draw our attention to is something they call the prize cases. And think about during the Civil War. Lincoln put a blockade down there for the southern ports. And so some folks sued because, you know, when you're at war, you can take other people's ship. They were called prizes. And so they were suing, saying our ships were seized. That's illegal, unconstitutional. And what the court said is the president in those type of situations where it's defensive in nature doesn't just have the authority to respond without authority of Congress, has a duty to respond to defend the country. And so this is where the courts have said, okay, the president doesn't just have to wait for Congress to do something. In a defensive nature, he has a duty to protect the nation. He has a duty to take those troops, those forces, to protect the country. Roll forward, you know, last time Congress officially declared war was 1942, World War II. But then after that, we got into Vietnam.
Yeah.
So in 1973, Congress passed the War Powers Act, or the War Powers Resolution. And it was trying to say when the president could and couldn't go in. And if he did go in, he had, you know, 48 hours to notify Congress and 60 days to have the troops there, or had to withdraw if Congress didn't approve it. But the courts have since said, OK, if Congress, you know, declares war,
yeah,
or if Congress does a resolution like authorized use of military force that we saw coming out of September 11, 9/11,
right.
You know, about, you know, the war in Afghanistan and then expanded into Iraq.
Yeah.
Those were deemed appropriate authorizations of the president to act. But even when Congress appropriates money, that can be a de facto declaration of war. And we've seen over the years an increased expansion of a standing army, which the founders were very concerned with, and the president taking more and more action unilaterally under the authorization that he's saying this is defensive in nature.
Yeah.
Now, when you step back and you think about the broader international laws when it comes to war making, this is where the UN Charter, Article 2, talks about member states cannot threaten or use force against territorial integrity or political independence of other member states.
Yeah.
And this is where, when we think about, you know, the U.S. and Iran, some people say, well, what happened there? Didn't they just go in against the territorial integrity of Iran?
I mean, or this raises for me Ukraine.
Or Ukraine and on and on and on.
Yeah.
And then we get into, you know, Article 51 of that, where it talks about, but a country can use self-defense.
Yeah.
It can defend itself. And then it even gets into anticipatory self-defense. When the attack is imminent, you don't have to wait for the attack and then respond. You can respond prior to the attack to blunt the attack taking place. And this is some of the argument that the presidents over the years have used, is there is an attack and we get to debate what does imminent mean.
Right.
But I am preemptively, in a measure of self-defense, protecting the nation. And it doesn't just mean the country, you know, our land or our territories. It also means our armed forces, wherever they might be, the president can use force to protect them.
Now, this
is a
place,
broader sense.
Yeah. So, and I think this is an important history, but it also, I think, along that explanation set off a lot of reminders for me, including weapons of mass destruction, right? You may remember the line that we were sold about getting into a protracted war in the Middle East over weapons of mass destruction that were not.
Especially in Iraq.
Yeah.
And some will say, well, they were there, we just didn't find them. Others will say Saddam Hussein was so masterful, making us think that they were there.
Yeah, yeah. Now, I think we're having a similar conversation around Iran's nuclear program, which may or may not have a weapon, right? And what we're being told.
Or maybe weaponized.
Or capacity,
You know, they argue potentially within days it could be weaponized.
Yeah, sure. Okay, so I think all of this leads to, I would say, some kind of bigger questions on, do you think that we are now at war with Iran?
I believe it was a war-type act.
Act.
Okay.
And you would say that's within bounds?
I will say that the president and many others will argue that that's within bounds.
Okay.
Many folks on different sides of the aisle in Congress will say it was out of bounds.
Yeah.
I personally come from the perspective where I think this is the type of thing where Congress either needs to act in one form or fashion to say this is a threat that we want the president to take the armed forces to protect ourselves against, or some may argue that Congress has already de facto in their appropriation of funding over the years and using that to repel different attacks against Iran to say that was already authorized.
Right. I think,
but it's troubling either,
it's
no matter
troubling.
How you slice and dice it. But this is where I want to help folks understand. It's a very muddy kind of process. There's not a clear line of what it means, Congress declaring war. It's over couple centuries, it's become very muddy.
Yeah, and it's become very muddy. I think it's difficult for Americans to have much of a memory about anything that we do internationally. And so I just want to drop some important dates along the way. I, listeners, am Iranian, half Iranian. My dad is from Tehran. The name Shireen is the Farsi word for sweet.
Oh, you were quite sweet. There you go.
I always say it's false advertising. But here are some things that are important to understand. So we have had a long and very complicated relationship with Iran. And one of the
45 plus decades. I mean, I remember Jimmy Carter, but going back even further
further. So 1953, we participate in regime change, which it sounds like maybe we're reengaging in now. That led to the Iranian Revolution in 1979, which is actually when my mom moved from North Dakota to teach at an American school in Tehran. Met my father as revolution is breaking out in the streets, is part of the group that's evacuated ahead of the hostage taking. In 1980, I believe, we cut diplomatic ties with Iran, all of that leading to a real backsliding for individuals. The way that people experience life, especially women experience life in Iran, has gotten significantly worse since we've gotten involved. but I mean, many other things that I don't really have time to talk about now, but all the way up to thinking about our relationship and negotiations around Iran's nuclear program, which started in 2013 under Obama, led to the JCPOA, which is the joint, plan of action.
Yeah.
Plan of action, basically saying that there were, I think, over a dozen countries involved in coming together to negotiate the JCPOA, which ultimately guided inspections, understanding of what kind of weaponization they were building, what the amounts of materials that they had, all of that. That was in place from 2015 until we withdrew. Trump withdrew us from the JCPOA in 2018. And frankly, we have had much less visibility, understanding, and capacity to really investigate what Iran is doing with their nuclear program. Then, in the last 2 weeks, Trump has been threatening to bomb them, and there's really significant risk that they've already moved the materials that they need to quickly develop this kind of weaponry because of the completely unhinged and public nature of our president in saying, maybe I'll do this, maybe I'll do that, I'm going to do this, I'm going to do that. And in fact, one of the biggest risks that's been reported from our own military to operational security around what's happening right now in the Middle East is our own president and the way that he is absolutely unpredictable and undisciplined in his telecasting or forecasting what he thinks he might do or not do. I think we're in a much more dangerous time because of this president. Where are you at?
Well, I was going to say, you brought up weapons of mass destruction.
Yeah.
And this is where the intelligence community was saying, we believe Iraq has weapons of mass destruction. Now, flip this around. Tulsi Gabbard recently, head of the intelligence community, said that they were saying they continue to assess that Iran is not building a nuclear weapon.
Yeah.
Okay. And so the president, when asked about this, said, my intelligence community is wrong. And so this is where the intelligence community today is kind of saying, the opposite. They are not, I mean, maybe they're on the verge of something, but they are not currently building a nuclear weapon.
Yeah.
And the president's saying, yeah, I don't care.
Doesn't care. I'm going to do it anyway. Well, it's a very troubling time. And I know that we spent a lot of time explaining this, but listeners, I hope you're willing to kind of come with us on this journey of understanding how complicated, and I think how much we've deferred as a nation. I would prefer that my representatives had to decide if we were going to war or not. I would prefer that we had a Congress that really was responsible around these decisions.
There's a reason why the founders did this.
Yeah.
And I think we need to work to push that back into Congress and make them stand up and belly up to the bar with these kind of decisions.
I couldn't agree more. Well, listeners, you're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle. I'm Shireen Gourbani. This is John Dougal across from me, and we will be right back. You're listening to Both Sides of the Aisle on Utah Public Radio. We love to hear from listeners like you. If you would like to send us a comment, email bsotapodcast@gmail.com. That's bsotapodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening. Shireen Gourbani on the left.
John Dougal on the right.
We're unsupervised today.
Natalie's away. We will play.
We will play. So another time that I get to bring up one of my least favorite representatives, Mike Lee, says he
is
going
to. But how do you really feel?
I know. He says he's going to revisit a controversial plan to sell off public land. So we just heard this morning that a proposal that he had to sell 3.3 million acres of public lands across the United States, but largely in the West, was pulled out of the budget bill that's going through. Give me your thoughts on this.
So the first thing I want to just lay out for folks is Utah is two-thirds owned, controlled by the federal government. And I've always told folks, whoever controls the land controls the economy. And in various parts of Utah, especially in rural Utah, that means the federal government is controlling their economy. I think the federal government has too much control in Utah. I think we should be talking and debating this. And the federal government should be divesting itself of large pieces of land, especially in the West.
Yeah.
As a comparison, in Texas, about 3% of Texas is federal lands. In Connecticut, it's about 0.3%.
Yeah.
Versus 66, 67% out here, and I think 87% in Nevada.
So I'll just add that our public lands are huge drivers of our economy here. So billions of dollars a year are coming into the state because of travel and tourism that is driven largely by our public lands, right?
And I come from the perspective also when it comes to mining and mineral extraction and so forth. Too often, the Biden administration, for example, locked up those lands basically forced it out of the U.S., out of Utah. And I think we would benefit economically by unleashing that.
In some cases. And then in others, I'll just say Trump did unlock it. And many of those parcels were not bid on. They were not competitive for this kind of thing. What was so unhinged about this proposal from Mike Lee is that it was supposedly in an effort to increase affordable housing. But to be clear, portions of our ski resorts were included in this. Portions of, I believe, Granger Peak. This weekend, I hosted a reunion of Peace Corps volunteers. We went out to Fifth Water. We went out to the Hot Springs. That was in this proposal. The amount of public land...
He was looking at a certain distance from cities or towns.
The amount of public land that was included in this is truly, like, would be decimating to our experience. I think the other thing that was something I learned running for Congress in Southern Utah, if we're talking about lands where BLM lands, where a lot of our farmers and ranchers graze down there, the cost that it would actually be to those ranchers to graze on land, should it come out of federal hands, is, it would not be economically feasible for those folks to have their cattle on that land if it were owned privately. There are so many ways that this is a misguided policy, and I just fundamentally believe that one of the things that I continue to love, however unhinged our politics gets here in Utah, is our access to public lands, and I'm glad to see this proposal is out for now.
And I come from the perspective where historically the federal government was supposed to divest itself of most of this land, and you look at the homesteading that took place, you know, over American history, and somehow when it hit the West, it largely stopped. So, and that, to me, is a problem.
So this is a little bit of a different take on it, but let's talk briefly about what's happening in Vineyard. So this is, we'll say this is a land management developer issue as well. So what's going on in Vineyard?
So one of the, backing up just a little bit. So Geneva Steel used to be located here at Vineyard. Vineyard used to be a very small town, 100-something folks. It was largely the steel mill.
Yeah. And right this, there. For and listeners, is just on the other, just south of Salt Lake County. It's the one of the fastest growing cities.
It's basically between Orem and Utah Lake.
Yep. Yep.
And Geneva Steel, just for backstory, World War II, we were afraid of the Japanese bombing our steel plants. And so that's why Geneva Steel was here. It was inland enough that the Japanese couldn't reach it. So then Geneva Steel closes. There's a lot of blight here. There was an RDA created to rejuvenate this, and now Vineyard is a booming town. But it turns out that Vineyard, through the RDA, has not been fully accounting to the auditor's office some expenditures, especially to developers.
Yeah.
And so this is concerning. This is one of those things that was starting to bubble up just as I was wrapping up my tenure as auditor. Auditor Cannon went in and looked at it and issued a limited review, finding that they were not adequately reporting. Now, I get that the mayor down there is saying, oh, but this and that, and you know, there's an auditor alert in May. Hey, there's always been a standing requirement for cities and local governments to report their financial revenues and expenditures to the auditor's office. That was in place even before I became auditor over 12 years ago.
Yeah. So in one of the ways, though, we've seen, I would say, some backsliding from our current representatives here at the state level in Utah around transparency. This is a place where we still have quite a bit. And we actually have a website that people can...
Transparent.utah.gov. Transparent.utah.gov is the website we created.
Yeah. And so there were basically this failure to disclose this information that, so it didn't show up there. And I do think it's really hard for people to follow this kind of, these kind of deals, this kind of, I would say, questionable behavior when we do not have this kind of transparency. So I'm glad we have this. One other thing I just want to add to listeners' awareness is that there is, you may remember, there was a very big effort to repeal an anti-union bill that was passed this last legislative session. This was a, specifically, it was anti-collective bargaining. So this bill said that public employees could not participate in collective bargaining. So that meant our teachers, our cops, our firefighters would be barred from participating in collective bargaining. A huge effort.
A concept that conservative FDR championed as well.
So a huge effort underwent across this entire state. If I'm not mistaken, they received the signature threshold by over double. So and it was a high bar.
And this is one of those things. When the legislature passes something, if they don't get a 2/3 vote in the House and the Senate, then voters can go out and sign a referendum to vote to repeal, or vote to consider whether to repeal the action the legislature took.
So they got twice the number of signatures they needed, far exceeded. They also were supposed to hit, I think, 15 out of 29 of our Senate districts, and I believe they got to 23, if not 27. I know that it was a massive showing of support for this. So now,
and this is where you and I disagree. I actually think the bill is a good thing, but yeah.
I just want to let people know that it is going to be on your ballots for the 2026 midterms. So you will be able to vote if you think that public sector employees, again, teachers, firefighters, cops, should have the opportunity to collective bargain, and you're going to be able to vote on it. And I know how you'll be voting, John.
Yeah, you'll know how I'll vote. Yeah.
Okay, so turning to...
But this is one of those other things. One of the broader things that colors this is this will motivate a bunch of Democrats to get out to vote on this measure, and what ripple effect will that have on other state elections?
Yeah, and I think...
House seats, Senate seats, so forth.
In this moment, you can count on us to be motivated. We are motivated.
There's a difference between motivation and getting to the polls.
Yeah, I don't know. 2018 is a good example, I think.
But this is the type of thing that will, I think, tend to get, Team D to the polls.
Yeah, or people who are just fed up with how things are going. I mean, a lot of Utahns say one of their biggest concerns with our representation here is that they do not listen. And this was a place where we had really bipartisan coalition building, Republicans and Democrats, workers standing shoulder to shoulder saying we want the right to collective bargain. And I think the signatures, really show that the strength of this signature gathering process really show that. But let me just add that 2026 is interesting thinking back to 2018 when we also had medical marijuana on our ballots. We had Medicaid expansion on our ballots, which is currently under threat by this current administration, but also better boundaries, fair districts. And it's when we sent Ben McAdams, who sometimes sits in with us, to Congress. So I do think that we're in a moment again where we could see some real political shifting ground in Utah. So I want to...
And you mentioned the better boundaries.
Yeah.
But this is one of the things that we're still waiting for from the Supreme Court is their opinion on, I think it was out of Louisiana, the redistricting case that's before them that we haven't seen their opinion yet, but anticipate it any day now.
Is that right? Yeah. I kind of forget what's happening at that national level. But what I will say is I do think, we know from their votes that Utahns believe that they should get to pick their politicians, not the other way around. The politicians shouldn't get to pick their voters. And I do think that we would have a much more functional and fairer government if we had fair districts. And maybe, honestly, we'd have a more functional Congress if we had more competitive districts. The vast majority of districts across this entire country, because Democrats and Republicans participate in gerrymandering, are far enough out of reach that we get people who
are... The contest is in the primary. It's not in the general election.
And we get people who are more ideological, they're more interested in fundraising, and they're less interested in actually governing. And I think we'd do better in more competitive races.
On both sides of the aisle.
Yeah, I really do. I really do. So I'm going to turn to something that is just really devastating. We had the opportunity to acknowledge the life that was lost in the No Kings rally last week on our program. But now we're in this place where we're really trying to understand Utah's gun laws. It does seem that the individual who was initially accused of, potentially creating a threat with an AR-15 style weapon is actually somebody who was participating in Utah's open carry.
And supposedly does it quite regularly.
It does it quite regularly.
And this is where, while I support open carry, I sometimes tell folks, just because you have the right and the ability to do it doesn't necessarily mean you should.
You should. Yeah. I think for me, it's such a unnerving experience to see, which I've seen typically on the right, honestly, but occasionally on the left, as we saw just this last week. I find it terrorizing. I find it terrorizing to see somebody walk through our streets open carrying a weapon, especially a weapon of that size, right? But what's happening now is that one of the peacekeepers who thought they were responding to a threat is the person who actually shot and took the life of this individual. I mean, what do you think
this,
we do
this
here?
This other individual that was killed. Yeah. And this is why, just because this individual had the right, this is where I say sometimes you don't exercise. You can make your case without that. But because of it was viewed as provocative, this person reacted thinking they were protecting the peace. Innocent bystander was tragically killed as a result. I don't think our laws should change on that, but clearly we need to get a better understanding of how to engage appropriately.
Yeah. Yeah. Well,
and like you said, for various folks, if they see a gun like that, they feel very threatened as a result.
Yeah.
And that's why, when I was in the legislature, some folks would open carry at the legislature in committee, which guess what? it did not gain them the support that they thought they were going to get.
Right.
It actually cost them votes as a result of their antics.
Yeah. Yeah. And I find this, I guess I would just say, I find this heartbreaking. I find this so complex. I do continue to believe that we should have greater regulation, greater training, greater safety, a greater culture of care around guns. And just remind folks that, you know, the vast majority of life lost in Utah to gun violence is suicide. It's an individual deciding to end their own life. We're seeing more and more
reports
of access.
That's not really a gun thing. That's a mental health issue.
But,
right at that
but
point.
But access is important. How easy it is to access guns is a really important component of that. And we're also seeing devastating stories of accidental shootings. There was just another one in the news, a person who was killed just honestly playing with a gun. So store them safely. Take care of your neighbors. Please consider not open carrying at rallies. And we'll close the show there.
And it's one of those things. I'm going to just say on a positive note, we're coming up to Independence Day.
Yeah.
Think about what it is, what this nation stands for, the Constitution, and how do we uphold and protect that?
Yeah. Well, I'm Shireen Gorbani. That's John Dougal. You've been listening to Both Sides of the Aisle. Thanks to our producer, Anthony Scoma.